I brought reinforcements today. So your friends can be more than sentient beings, you know. There's a different kind of life that's not dependent on breathing. But if one enters into association with that, those of us who are breathing find a different quality of life. And so my special books are my friends and my constant companions. I will do the mandala offering for us first, and then we will open up. And it's an offering that I do. It's basically, generally we don't, it is transmitted to you, so you really can't use it without having a proper transmission. But because I know that you're not familiar with these kinds of practices, I'm just going to share out loud so that you understand what we're doing. So in the Dhamma, it constantly talks about, of course, if you haven't read the Majjhima Nikaya, then you probably don't know this, but I will say that it talks about one of the ways that we grow is by not being dependent on rules and rites and rituals. It doesn't mean you don't have any rules or rites or rituals, but it means that just by going through the motions, you're not going to get anything from that. That you bring to it all of the quality that it possesses. You bring to it all of the life that it has. And from this sincere place of the heart, you open yourselves up to the forces in the universe that are part of the natural order of things that can support you in your endeavors, in life. And so this speaks to establishing a Vajra ground, a sacred ground, a Vajra boundary, which are these four walls. Then I'll read the offering. Mount Sumeru, it's surrounding four continents. Its sun and its moon constitute the universe. So we're establishing a sacred place, a sacred mountain that's going from the earth up through the heavens to the sun and the moon as our universe, and we're offering all treasures in this universe to the Buddhas and to the Bodhisattvas. All of the great merit that we earn, we're willing to share with all living beings so that they may also realize enlightenment. That's part of the Bodhisattva vow, to save all living beings, not just our family, not just the ones that we love, not just the ones that look like us, not just the ones that are in a particular location like our country, but we are expanding our heart and offering everything that we inherit in this life good, all of our treasures, all of our money, all of our fame, just everything that represents goodness and progress in our life, that which we are truly, truly grateful for, that gives us a standard of living and a standard, a way of understanding our life and understanding people. All of this we're willing to share, if there's any merit in it, with all beings everywhere, so that they may also realize this enlightening way of living and walking and having our being in the world. I and the other living beings here offer all of our physical actions, our speech, our thoughts, our wealth, our good fortune, in our past and our present and future lifetimes, and wonderful treasures. And who do we offer these to? Not just the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, but we offer them to our teacher. We offer them to our Yidam, being like a sort of like a spiritual guide, and to the three jewels. We are locked in a certain time, space and time continuum here on this earth, but it doesn't mean it's the same everywhere. You know, that's why we get echoes that come from, you know, galaxies that are so far away, and it might have taken I don't know how many lifetimes for that sound to reach us, because it's through our movement in light that we have an establishment of time. Time is not really real. Time is an illusion. However, it is the movement of activity. That's what creates time, and it's our relationship to that movement. That's why you can be doing something that you like, and the time goes by so fast, and you're doing something like that you don't like, and time drags on and seems to never come around. That's why when Tawari was tapping her watch last night, I said, wait a minute, you know, she's like, I still had 15 minutes. And she was like, she was sure I was over time or something. I'm like, well, she must not like that too much, because it seemed to take a long time for her. But for me, it goes like that. You know, because of the integration into it. And when I first started, I didn't have any understanding of it. But what I knew is that what I had already had was not enough for me to give my whole life, to change my whole perspective, to subdue myself based on the promise that something was coming out of this teaching that was going to be more than ordinary. And over the years, over 20 or 30 years, you know, it got, frankly, it got right ordinary. And I said, is this all that there is? This is what a Buddha makes an appearance in the world? Do I really believe in Buddhas? Do I really accept when I take this vow? Is it a sincere vow? You know, and this offering of respect, do I, and he's just telling me everyday, ordinary, run-of-the-mill stuff. You know, so I was looking for something that was beyond what my mind couldn't conceive. And that is the purpose of a teacher, to expand the opening, to create a space for a trajectory that one can grow, and one can mix their own ordinary wisdom with the supreme wisdom of the Dhamma, of it's just the natural order and the force of the whole universe. Now, I was looking for something like that. I mean, when you give up your life or something, you expect it to be for something, you know? Otherwise, I'll just go back out, get my good job, buy my fancy car. She got a car. And I was the... And I was so shocked, you know, because I used to come until COVID, and, you know, and I didn't, like, understand this way, because I'm in a small town. My monastery is in a small town. And she said, we have to go get the car. I said, where the car? She said, oh, it's up there. You know, they have cars all over town, you know, and you, like, get one, and you go places, and you park it, and come home. And this was, like, so fascinating to me, because I could only think of one way that people, you know, drive and have mobility. And you had scooters that you rent and go places, so people didn't have a car note and all that kind of stuff. And I thought, this is marvelous, you know. But then she came, and she had a really nice car. And I mentioned something about the car, and she said, oh, yeah, finally, you know, I have to move around so much that I really needed to do this so that I can really be accessible to the Dhamma, you know. And I was just shocked, but I'm so happy for her. No, I'm so joyful. I mean, this is a way that one lives, you know. She had to wait. Let me see if I can reserve a car. Okay, I got one. I got to walk four blocks to get it. You stay here. I'll be right back. I said, she need a car. You know, and here she has a car, so I'm so happy. I remember one time my pastor, when I was in the church, well, it was the pastor's daughter, and she was also a minister, but she was a little janky. You know, her mother was the real deal, but she was hanging on a coattail and wanted respect that she didn't earn in her behavior. And But I tried to use her as my practice. You know, every Sunday that she gave a sermon, her sermon was on me, you know, and I have to sit there and take it. So I learned something early on about overlooking slight and tolerating a fault. And I tell you, it makes you an overcomer in this life, because we live in a world where there's going to be a whole lot of that, you know, just because of our avidya, because of our ignorance. We are just covered in unwholesome thought and unwholesome behavior. And so that's why Buddha comes into this world, to rectify that. But we have to want rectification. Is that a word? We have to want to be rectified. We have to want things to be rectified. I was talking with someone, and this person, like, they were in a worse state than the last time I had seen them, you know, because they're not willing to let something go. They're not willing to tolerate a slight, overlook a fault. And so they're in constant suffering. Are you in constant suffering over something that somebody said that's hurt your feelings, something that somebody said that's maybe even trying to create a little problem for you? And when they're using their capacity as a human being to cause a problem for you, there is power in that. They can do that. They can cause you problems, but they know that. So they have confidence in their badness, that it will bring about the desired result. But do you have confidence in your goodness? There is the practice that one engages in, where one learns and commits themselves to overlooking slights and tolerating faults, and the reward for that is that one's peace is not destroyed, that they are not perturbed, that they can be happy regardless of what's going on. That's priceless. But it costs us something to get into that space. I tell you, it just cost us the willingness to, and the laying down of our sense of pride in who we are. But I tell you, the reward of it is so great, because every day you can have peace. Some of us work with people that we if we chose, we wouldn't work with them. Well, a monastery, you know, I can't really like. I can say yes or no, but I don't really choose the people that come, you know? If I discern that they are sincere in their aspiration and their desire, I am required to take them in, whether they're my kind of peeps or not, whether we, like, see things the same way or not, whether, you know, and if they have the determination to examine themselves and line up with the Dharma and thereby become a new creature, then how can I refuse them? If there's an issue, it's with me. I can only handle my own part of that. I have to get myself together. What's my great vow? Not what's hers. What's my great vow? So people think, oh, well, y'all in the monastery, y'all don't have go through anything like all y'all birds of a feather flock together and everybody's talking. No, it's not like that. They're people. They came from out here. We all came from out here, in here, and now it makes it so worse is at the end of the day, when you're with somebody you don't like, you can go home, right? But when I'm with them and they're with me, ain't nowhere to go. You know, we are home. And so we have to deal with each other 24/7. That can really be grating unless you see a value in it that can transform you in a certain way. And that is that's the power of the Dharma. It has the power to release you, like the lotus growing up in the mud, to release you from all of this that's going on around you, on your job, in your home life, you know, with your loved ones, with your friends, with your enemies, with strangers, ones who think like you and ones who don't think like you. It challenges you to come up to your high. I'm going to open in a minute. Forgot. It challenges you to come up to your highest and to your best. It's what I'm saying. This is powerful stuff. It's like working with, how did JJ used to say, but working with dynamite. And you have a joy that flows from the inside, and nobody can take that away from you. You can give it away. You can lay it down, but nobody can take it away from you. When it is sincere, it becomes a fabric of your being. It becomes who you are. And that's different from having all of these pithy sayings and, you know, you can like preach or teach the Dharma so good and you have a command and you're you're such a scholar and this and that. You know, most of the scholars aren't even practitioners. They're not yogis. You know, so how are you going to interpret, a yogic experience through your words and then expect us to line up with the words? That's why we ain't got no power, because we are relying upon, and this is not, any scholars in here, I'm not talking about you. I'm speaking in a general term. You know, there's a friend of mine, a very, very, very well-known, he is a monk, and he's a scholar, and he does a lot of translations, and he's great at translating. And we are the better for him being here. But he doesn't meditate at all. Never has. Says, when I try, I get a headache. So I just abandon it. So he can't help me understand, decipher, and break down, you know, meditative experience. Because he doesn't know. But people think he knows because he can translate Pali words into English and Sanskrit words into English. And so there is a space that he occupies that is helpful to us in a certain kind of wisdom that's called language prajna. Because language prajna starts from duh, don't know anything, to something. But language prajna can only go so far. It can only go so far. Some things have to be directly known. Somebody said to me, I used to be married a few times, but somebody says to me, I know your husband so well. I said, what's she telling me that for? I'm like, you don't know him as well as I do. You know, just talk, you know. And so there's some things that you can get from talk, but there are some things that you have to actually investigate by putting yourself into it and seeing what comes out of it. And what comes out of it for you is a way that you know it, that I don't know it. I know it from my side. But no interpretation is private that I tell you what it means. You have to have the experience to know what it means. And so, I stopped and did that explanation right in the middle of the mandala offering, which you should not do. I had a wonderful father. And mother, not so much, but I've learned to love her, and I wish I had learned while she was still alive. You know, even on her deathbed, when I was telling her how much I loved her, all she could say was, me too. That was it. I never sat on her lap. She never held me. Even when she braided my hair, she would turn me backwards, so I'm facing out that way, and then she would braid. And she would braid. But my other sisters, they would be facing her. Her arms would be around them, and she'd braid this way, you know. And so I had a few issues with her as I grew up. But I wish that I had done enough of my cultivation, because I did learn to love her near the end. But it was too late for us to have a life together then, you know. And I forgave everything. Now, where I am today, there would not even be anything to forgive. Who knows, if I had had the training that I have now through the Dharma in the system that I was in, which is a good system, But in my Christianity, it allowed for faults, and I had to learn how to forgive. In Dharma, it doesn't allow for faults. So that's why we have nothing to forgive. We understand causality, cause and condition. That anything that's showing up is showing up due to causes and conditions. So it is right here because we've created the actions that produce certain conditions. And this can be kind of difficult to see on a long spectrum, you know, like why was I born into the family I was born into? Well, do you think that just that moment of conception coming into this life is all that there was? You know, what created the condition? You could say, well, mom and dad getting together. That's what created the condition. But you could always ask the question, and what came before that? Because whatever is present, something came before that created the condition for that to come about. And that's just a universal law. We can like it, we can not like it, you know, but that's according to the Dharma. And I'm going to tell you what the Dharma says today. So it's not like me speaking for me. It's me speaking what the Dharma says. If you say you ascribe to it, you need to know what it says. And you need to ponder those things and see if there's a place that you can get to that's acceptable. If not, find a tradition that you can, because that only then can you live authentically. When I could no longer live authentically in my other tradition, I looked for something. I said, I need something higher. And I looked for something, and I found something. You know, there was a long night of the soul, but I knew it was time for me to make that exit, because within that tradition, I was in mystical Christianity, like that's as high as you can go there. And if that didn't give me all my answers, then I needed to keep looking. It didn't mean that I had to necessarily throw away everything I had, you know, but I needed something else to add to it, just kind of like stepping. So different doesn't necessarily mean deficient or bad or not useful. It just means different, you know. And I needed more. And so I had this vision. I was a pastor. I had this vision, and I was in the bride chamber with Jesus. And I had known him since I was a little girl, when he walked through a wall and just like this shimmering image and revealed itself to me. And I'm trying to tell my parents. I mean, they go to church, right? I'm trying to tell them about this, and they tell me ain't no such thing. I'm like, so they don't know what's happening. And so then I went to my pastor, and I told my pastor this and what he had said to me. And that happened when I was 6, happened again when I was 13. They didn't know what to do with me in the Baptist church, because we didn't do that kind of thing. You know, so my sister said, you know, I want to take you and show you something. There's this place, it's a storefront church, and them people, they be hollering and shaking and speaking in tongues, flipping over chairs. And, you know, we go there to like they went there to laugh at it, you know. And then when they took me in there, I found my peeps. For a long while, I was in that space. You might call it like the Kundalini rising and the, you know, channels opening up in the body. But we wasn't studying nothing about channels and chakras and stuff. Like, we're in black church, you know. And so we weren't learning about it in that way, you know. But that's what was happening. That's why we could put our hands on a hot radiator. It's steaming, you know. It's the kind of, y'all might not know about radiators. But hot steam comes out the radiators and heats the room, you know. Hands on the radiators don't even burn. Flip over, hit your head on the concrete, doesn't even hurt. You know, you get so excited, you just fall out. You just run, just all kinds of things, you know. But I wanted to know what this is, more than this outward something or other, something happening to these people, and something's happening to me. And I want to know what it is and how it is, by what means it is, and what does it mean, and what is it good for, you know? And so I stayed in that tradition for a while. a long time. Then I was working in a hospital, and I was on the hospice ward, you know. So they have that thing kind of down to a science. They know how long a bed's going to be occupied, how much medicine they're going to dish out, how they don't, you know. And they came to me and said, "We're having a little problem on your ward because the people not dying fast enough." That was the bottom line. And they were saying, like, "What'd you?" I said, "Well, if they come to my ward, I'm praying for their life. You know, they need one more chance." And so I'm holding on to people. They transferred me out. They did. They said, "Well, you want to help people, we'll send you over to the WIC department." And then they made me the coordinator of WIC, where I, you know, give out food and stuff like that. They said, "We put you over there. We're going to put somebody else over here." And that's what they did. But in that process, those same doctors who had to make those decisions, they had a little secret meeting down in the basement. And I tell these stories because stories help you to understand principles better than just words. You know, and so they have me in the basement. They meet in the basement. When I get down in the basement, they're all Catholics. Now, I'm not Catholic, right? And they were charismatic Catholics at that. And I was Pentecostal, you know, long black dresses, you know, and all of that. Bible thumping and mad with everybody kind of. So I'm down in the basement, and they're all like singing in tongues, and they're dancing, doing the Cherokee Hill, and they're, you know, doing all this Jewish dancing, and they were like, and locking arms, and they were like, "This in this glorious space." And I'm like, "What is that?" And that can't be tongues they're speaking, because it doesn't work like that. They are singing in harmony, and, you know, and there was an order to it. And I said, "Well, that can't be true, because when it hits me, I'm like this, you know." And so she said, "But that's just because you don't know how to harness the power of it, the waking up, you know." She said, "But we can teach you, you know." And I said, "No, I don't think this is real." I went back to my church. But then when I looked at how refined that expression was, you know, how uplifting it was. It just wasn't all razzmatazz all over the place, you know. It became something. I said, "Well, if it's real, then I want it." You know, because they were being lifted up into some states that were blissful and sublime and refined. So I came back and said, "Okay, all right. She says, "Well, you know, but you have to yield yourself to this." I said, okay, "I'm going to do that, you know." Next thing you knew, I was just like them, you know, and just the refinement and the urge to fight and be bodacious was gone. You know, I had some strength, but not in a refined kind of way. And so then I left the Pentecostal church and I went to the charismatic church. But after some years there, 5 or 6 years, I'm like, "This is all nice and everything, you know, but there's, you know, like down underneath, I'm still me. I can tell you, you catch me at the wrong time, you'll know I'm still me. I know how to put on that face, you know, or now I don't know. Because you come into a place of being just really having an integrity to be actually honest, you know, and that's the first step, you know, because we are all walking around with masks on. We can be different ways for different people, you know, or for what we want to reveal and what we want to conceal. But the first step in going on this path is a radical honesty. Who? With other people? No, it's with yourself. Most of our discomfort comes from the fact that we know we're so fake, you know? And really being honest, when we said we tried our best, we know we didn't. We gave them what we thought they deserved, just that much grace. Or when we said that, you know, And I started to see, after all of these years, I am such a hypocrite, you know. Know how to carry myself. Know who to act in a certain way around, you know. But there's this song that says, like, if you went to a town and nobody knew you, how would you act? Well, I could tell you, I've been all over the country, you know, for the last 2 decades and all over the world. I can't go anywhere without somebody running into me and say, are you Poniwati? You know, I get no break. So I had to, like, just give it up, you know. And I'll tell you the truth. When I'm telling something on myself, but I don't care because I want somebody to hear me in here. So when I first became a nun, in the world, I was in banking and finance, and you know, like you can only be so scrupulous or you'll be killed in that industry. You learn how that they make the rules, like, so I don't make them, I just carry them out. I just follow them. And so there's a whole banker mentality that I'll tell you is completely different from just an ordinary mentality. I'm still paying. I still have karmic retribution coming from those days that I thought like a banker. And I operated like a banker. You don't get what you deserve. You get what you negotiate. And that's how I was, you know. And seeing, it took the Dharma to help me see the error in that way of thinking. I'm like, this is just the world. You can pick a low seat, a high seat. You know, whichever one you pick, don't be belly aching about it. Don't like that one, take a different seat. And so that's how I was. And when I was introduced to the Dharma, and I got the shock of my life because it stripped me bare, and I saw myself. The good little Christian that was running, and this is not anything against Christianity. This I'm speaking about me now. That's running around looking so great and so selfless because I had access to perks, and you throw them perks out and people think you're something that you're really not. But my mind was defiled and it was wrapped up in the finances. So when I became, one reason I became a nun was I made a vow to myself to make amends, you know, for the things that I had done. I look and see how much a person can afford, and I sell them that particular mortgage that gets me the most money based on what they can afford. Not giving them the best deal. I could have given them a best deal, but they can afford this one. I'll give them this one because I make more money. I mean, just things like that. You know, and that's what we do. And then we package it up and sell it off, replace our money, and do the same thing over and over and over. That, you know, in my lifetime, thousands of clients. So you can imagine how heavy my karma was. So I decided I wouldn't just be a layperson. You know, I really wanted to go all out and spend my last 20 or 30 years, you know, not making amends, just simply doing good. Doing good. And what better way than the way that I learned how to be good. And so that's why I became a nun. And I can tell you that it's been the most rewarding life for me, even though I gave up the riches and the money and the cars and the mansion and all of that, you know. But I'm rich beyond measure. The only thing I said is, okay, I'm going to do this, but I don't want to have to beg. I don't want to have to ask anybody for anything. If the teaching opens up a way, then I can receive, but I don't want to ask anybody for anything. There have been lots of times I went way hungry, you know. But yet, there was such a satisfaction inside that I had come to my true home, my true estate now. It doesn't, now, when the Buddha started teaching, the first thing he taught was generosity. So I'm not going to teach them any Dharma yet until I can see that a spirit of generosity has arisen in them. So we don't like to teach about generosity because we're actually on the opposite end. We have a different vow, you know, of not taking, you know, anything, only accepting what's given. And so we don't even want to talk about money at all, you know. But yet we have to teach people that one has to give oneself away. And that's the beginning of unloading this selfishness, and I call it selffulness that we have, that we sit in the center of our world and everything revolves around it. On the first layer, it's my family, you know, or my children or my spouse or whatever. And then go out a little further, it's my extended family. Go out a little bit further, it's my friends. You go out a little bit further, it's, you know, my associates. You go out a little bit further, it's my community. You go out a little bit further, it's my town, my city, my country, you know, and it just spins out and you're so far like I can't even see you. And so it's this self fullness that I sit in the center of my world. But I tell you the truth, there is a way of living in this world where you are not in the center. And what you give up in that, all we look at is what outer giving up, but what you really give up in that is all your dissatisfaction when things don't go the way you want them to go. You give up your anxiety around what's it going to cost me. I don't mean just in terms of money, you know, but what is it going to cost? What are they going to ask me to do? What do I have to, you know? It allows you to give up your sorrow that comes from grasping for loved ones. I had a partner in this work with me, and he was a monk, and we walked together for 30 years. In 30 years, we never had one argument. So I just don't understand people who argue every day. I never had one argument. So we have some arguments in the monastery sometime. Well, I don't, because I'm like the enforcer. I hope none of my nuns don't. Okay. Yeah, so. But I watched them, like, quibble. I'm like, just knock that off. You know? I mean, I just don't understand. Just because after 30 years, it's just not there. You know? And he died a couple of years ago. And I never missed a beat. Had Dharma the very next day. You know, in between, I got everything together. You know, I knew he was well-practiced and well-disciplined. So I wasn't by his bedside trying to get him saved or anything. I knew he knew how to handle his business. For me, I may have wanted to comfort him in a certain way. But I knew him. And I knew that this was a time I needed to keep my butt out of it and let him do his work. Because he was transitioning. No time for Paniwati being selfish because of stuff she want to say, or because, you know, she want to check and make sure he's ready and okay. What if he wasn't? You know, what? Yeah. You know, so and then, and I kept out the people who would pull on him and draw his energy and just let him do his work. And when I had observed that he was so stoic, to where he could tell you never have met a person who was so stoic. And I needed him because I was so fire that it just kind of balanced, and we had a wonderful ministry together. So if somebody needed something done, I'm your person. I can do that. If you needed to hear, well, you can do that if you want to. But just remember, that's the decision you made. You know, then that would come from him. You know, so I would do things. He said, well, are you sure you want to do that? I said, yeah, I do. You know, I might get mad if they act out, but I still want to do it because I really love them. He said, okay, just remember that. He says, and when stuff hits the fan, don't call me. He said, you just take care of that. I said, oh, he'll help me anyway, you know. But when stuff would hit the fan, he said, you created that. He said, so now you have to fix that. And so I learned something about handling my own problems. It's so wonderful, though, when you learn to handle your own problems. Then they don't, like, really become problems because you handle them. You know, handling them might mean that you have to step forward and do something that feels really uncomfortable. But you know that that needs to be done because that's the only way that's going to get resolved. And so you can make the tough decisions. You can do the tough things. My phone's been blowing up. People calling me because they need money for things, because they know I will help them with things. I said, I'm not here right now, so call me back when I get in. Calling me in the middle of the night, call me last night, call me four nights ago. You know, terrible story. You know, somebody's got children. They have and a wife, and their car broke down. But not only did their car break down, you know, they don't have any food. Not only do they not have any food, you know, their utilities about to be cut off. Not only the utilities, you know, they give me all. I said, okay, here, this is what you do. I said, you go to AIM and you get food. He's too proud to go to a food bank and get food. So he wanted me to give him money to go to the store to buy food. I said, no, you have to go to the food bank, and they will give you food. And then you go here, and they will help you. You know, and so I'm talking, and I said, I'm going to give you some money. I'm going to help you get your truck fixed, because that's how he works. He needs his truck. And I wired him some money. I get a call a couple of days later. He said, won't you know, I was able to get my car fixed. And so what I'm telling you is all worldly Dharma, you know, is Buddha Dharma. I mean, this is where you need it for, how to operate in this world and to set yourself up so you don't come back here again. And so he says, I did what you said. I got the a car fixed, you know, and did this. But one thing he didn't do, what do you think it was? The food bank. He didn't want to go publicly. He didn't want to say, I need help. You see, that's that pride. Even when you can't feed your two children and your wife, his pride would not let him go. So he said, I spent some of the money for food. So then I get a call last night at midnight. It was 10 o'clock. That means it's 1 o'clock. In the morning, 1 a.m., and he says, I just ran out of gas. I text back, so. And so he says, I said, I gave you money. You asked for money. The Buddha says if somebody comes to you in need, your friends, he was talking about friendship, and he says, this is my friend. He's my friend. He's my plumber. I pay him, but, you know, I'm a friend to him. And it says that if your friend comes and asks you for help and it's within your power to help them, you should help them. He said, and give them even more than they asked for. So I did. I gave him the money to fix the car, but I gave him more than what he asked for. I gave him money for gas, so money to pay his cell phone so he'd get his pings to go on his plumbing jobs. I gave him something so that he could move forward. And I told him not to spend any of it on food to go to the food bank. You know, so I have to make a phone call, and they will serve anybody that I send. They know I can't take care of that. And he didn't do it. So he would have had enough to have a full tank of gas, and he would not have run out of gas that night. Now, this is not something that Pañawati needs to know as Pañawati. This is just wisdom speaking. Like, if you're going to help him, what does it really take for him to move forward tomorrow being able to function? And it's more than just what he's asking you for, which is get the car fixed, a fuel pump or whatever. He's got to have gas to get to a job. You know, he's got to have a cell phone so he gets the call to make his runs, his contracts. That's what he needs. So this whole idea of the Bodhisattva is not just somebody who can teach Dharma or share Dharma or give you a good feeling or make you feel better about yourself, but it's one who can meet the needs that exist in the world. And if we deflect or dilute our energies, we will find ourselves impotent and not able to make action in the world. And that's what's wrong. The bad people, they're doing good at their job. But it's us who don't have enough confidence in the power of goodness and virtue to be a sustainer of the world. You know? And we can't despise little actions because all these matter. I know it matters because he's my plumber, but I got an electrician and I just got a text that his employee shot him and killed him. And I know the man. He's the sweetest guy, but he does not know how to handle money. And he's always like robbing Peter to pay Paul. And he can give you such a sob story, you know. He was renovating a house and we were buying the house from him, but he needed the money by tomorrow. And I didn't know what he was in, but he was desperate and he needed it, you know. So the $65,000 that I was putting down, I gave him that without even having the contract. I said, but you show up here tomorrow. And we'll finish this contract, because he had to pay those people by 4 p.m. So there was some ankle-breaking, knee-busting people, somebody he owed. He was desperate and he was sweating. And yet he is, you know, he's a businessman, but everybody owes somebody. And he was, so I gave him the money. He did come by. And I said, now what I want you to do is I want you to sign off of this contract, because that's all you were getting out of this transaction. You are now done. You're paid off. And he signed off on that. And now I just have one buyer, a seller that I'm working with. But he got what he needed, you know. But I know him. That's what I'm saying. And I know the money got funny, robbing Peter to pay Paul. And that guy came for his money. And it took his life. We don't know who we save from themselves. But along with that comes the obligation to tell people the truth. And that can be hard to do. No. But you can get the fearlessness to do that. And I'll tell you that that action has power. It's not any kind of personal power. But the action has power. So if we want our actions to have power, we need to know what kind of actions we should engage in. And in order to engage in them effectively, there's some preliminary things that we should do. And so the Buddha talks about that. And when you come to the Dharma, and it starts with taking refuge. Now, this first refuge you're taking it out, you're going for refuge out of a I don't know mind. You know, I'm looking for something, I need something. That's one type of refuge. And that's usually the first refuge that we take. We go to the three jewels, the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and we take refuge in them. We want to learn something that can change the way we think and the way we act and the way that we speak. We have this desire, we want to learn something, and we take refuge. Later, there is the taking of a true refuge, that true refuge is now that I have some experience with this, I know I can rely upon it. So our first refuge is like seeing a door, a house, and you run in the door for safety. You don't know whether you're going to get it or not because you don't know what's behind the door, you know, but you're investigating. But later, based on your experiences in life, the things that you encounter and how you overcome them when you follow the advice, you say, this is pretty trustworthy. I can rely upon this. And in order to do that, you have had to not only ponder the sayings, but you've had to act on them, enact them, take them up. Try them. Sometimes it didn't feel that good, like the first time you humbled yourself and said, you know, I think he's acting out of line and I'm about to get just like him, you know, and you decided you wouldn't, because how does that make you any different than him? And you made it through that. And it kind of like singed. It didn't feel that good to one's ego and pride. But you suddenly realize you're developing a kind of spiritual pride, not spiritual arrogance, but a spiritual pride that sustains you, that actually felt better than when you were out there duking it out with your brand of, you know, repercussion or whatever you wanted to throw back on a person. And you said, oh, this felt even better than when I was defending myself, when I decided that I didn't need to. When I decided that I didn't have to yell back or throw something or think of some devious scheme, I'm going to get him and he's not going to know it's me. Or some kind of retribution wasn't in my mind. And my mind remained aloof. That's what aloof means. When you read about him and his disciples and it talks in the sutras and it talks about aloofness, it didn't mean high-minded and head tipped up. It meant riding above all of that. And there's something that comes with it that makes you think I am somebody. That's a first step. Because actually, what you are the things that you do. That's what you are. And so when we take up better behaviors, we feel better about who we are. And we begin to change, act differently, carry ourselves differently. And it doesn't mean that we are like just become doormats. I mean, I can give a firm no. I think you know that. I can give a no. But I don't have to have any attitude around it. It could just be a no. It can be no. So he called last night at 10, that's 1 a.m., and he says, starts with the story. My wife came to help me finish this job so we could get paid. And I've run out of gas. I was getting ready to do it. So I said, well, see, that was, you used that for food, right? I said, so I'm not sure I'm gonna do anything, and I've gone to bed. So call me tomorrow. So he just waited until it was tomorrow. That was like 1 a.m. and he called, and he took a picture of where he was. He's still in his truck outside this job, you know. So that was like about No, I think it was 3 a.m. that he called me. And so I said, okay, this is what I'm going to do. I said, now I want you to listen to me. I said, I'm going to send you $200 because it's going to take probably 100, 120 to fill up your truck because he's got like a, you know, bigger truck. I said, he said, well, you don't have to send me two. Just send me enough to get some gas. I don't even have to have a full tank. And I'm saying, and then what? You're going to be calling me, what day is this? Or you're going to be calling me in 2 days because you need more gas money. And what I'm telling you is you cannot call me. I will not answer your calls. So you get a full tank of gas, and then you have whatever's left for any other kind of emergency you need. I said, but listen to me. I said, because I love you, and this is my love speaking, you cannot call me. After you've been on your job, he was going to sell his title to somebody for 30 days, title to his car. And I said, don't do that because they're going to end up with your car because 30 days is not enough time. I said, but I'm going to give you 6 months to pay me back. Yes, you do have to pay me back because you work. You pay me back. And he said, okay, I'll give you the title. I said, no need to give me the title because if you don't pay me back in 6 months, I'm not going to take your car. But you know that you'll never be able to come back to me again. And that was it. And that's how I handled it. You know, there's many different ways to handle it. I want to tell you, I'm not giving you nothing because you didn't do what I told you to do. You know, but that was his choice. And then I now have a choice. How do I move out of my own understanding? Now, if I went around this room, it'd probably be 10 different opinions on what should have been done and how to handle him. But who knows the level of my care for this person? Who knows why I do what I did? It's because one time I had and we get freezing weather and pipes burst. And my pipes burst, and at that time I had a 90-bedroom hotel that I had bought for Dharma Center meditation center, no, retreat center and nunnery and all of that. And my pipes burst in one little section, and it cost $7,000 to fix it. But I couldn't pay a plumber. I didn't have the $7,000. And he was riding high. I said, oh, don't worry about it. Pay me when you can. And I did. I paid him. It took me about 3 months, but I paid him. And so I remember that when he comes to me for something. And he comes often because he's on a little skid right now, you know. So I want to support him and help him. That's the only fair. They said, well, he's using you now because he knows that because he did that one thing and waited on his bill, that he can come to you for anything. I said, that's all right. You know, he will learn me, you know. And so that's why I do what I did for him. But if you had to make that decision, you may have come up with a different decision, you see. But we're always so busy with our opinion about what somebody should have done that we don't know and can't discern the wisdom of what is really right within the structure of our own lives. And that's why our lives are all messed up, but we got advice for who? Who? Everybody. We got advice for everybody. But the first thing this Dharma does is it begins to teach you how to handle your own problems. Whether it means letting something go, not being attached to it, having to give it up, able to give it up, to abandon it for one's peace, not struggling. But sometimes we can't do that because we have to save face, right? And so it allows us to examine our life and see what our makeup is, how we have come together, and we can see then that we are a compounded thing. that we are our experiences. That we are our actions. And we're constantly putting together compounds and taking compounds apart, and we're calling that me. But I am merely the sum of my thoughts, my speech, and my action. A compounded thing that is constantly shifting and constantly changing. Yes, there is a body. We call it flesh. But as it breaks down, we start to figure out what it is in its elemental earth, air, fire, and water. When somebody dies, you observe and you see it going back to that. But we're also this energetic, vibrational thing that creates phenomena, vibrational phenomena that activates and moves things in the world. And we can call it thought, we can call it life, we can call it spirit, you can come up with whatever name, you know, you want to call it. But we know that it is something that interacts with the inert compounds of earth, air, fire, and water, and it has produced something that we call, for us, human, that we call for Bosco, the dog, that we call for Jinx, the cat, that we call for, you know, and we've named all of these things. But they don't, but they're really not a me. And that's all the Buddha was saying. He was saying, if the reason why you're suffering is because you have eye consciousness, you know, nose consciousness, ear consciousness, we see, hear, taste, touch, smell, and think, and thought consciousness, that's six. And then you have a seventh consciousness, and that consciousness we call like the, that's the busybody consciousness. That's always fabricating scenarios based on what the ear consciousness told them, what the eye consciousness, you know, showed them. You know, the eye just merely saw. The ear just merely heard. But to make it something, it took that seventh consciousness. And that's the one that gets all busybody into everything. And this is what I think and my opinions and my views and that, you know. And so that was a little messed up, and it's based on experience, but not necessarily right view, the right way. Right meaning resourceful, the most resourceful way to look at something. Instead, it clamps around the other six consciousnesses. Mine. And that's where that ego sense comes about. It's not really real, but because we've given it permission, because we thought it was real, then it's constantly telling us who we are and what we are and what we should do and what they should do. And so there's something mixed up in there. And then you have another consciousness. And that's where the seeds of karma store up. So it's like an object in motion remains in motion until it's stopped. Okay. So if I light a candle, the flame will burn until the ingredients that allow the fire to be present are consumed. And when they are, what will happen? What? The candle, the flame will go out, right? And so as long as there's the fuel that keeps that going, it's going to burn. But let's say now it's getting down to the bottom and I still want the light or want the heat or whatever, you know, I can take that last little flame and I can light another one. And now that one can go out and I still have another one. Now my question is that flame this flame? Was it the previous flame? Or was it not? Now I'm talking about how you can understand rebirth linking consciousness or reincarnation. You said that's the dumbest thing I ever heard, you know. But now he's giving you an example. So that flame went out, but it first transferred its remaining capacity here for its continued expression. If you see an oak tree and an acorn falls to the ground and it starts to produce another tree, is it the original oak tree? Is it not the original? It is and it isn't, right? It both is and it isn't. It came from that tree. It's part of that tree. And now it's part of this tree. So you could say, no, that's not that tree, because that tree is there. It's this tree, but it's not that tree, because it was part of that tree. So things can be two ways. They can be it is, and it can be it isn't. So Buddha says, use that as an example to help you understand how we could be formed of emptiness, that something comes out of that no particular thingness. Something comes out and takes form. But yet its original nature is emptiness. Emptiness not in the sense of nothingness, but emptiness in the sense of no particular thingness. And it's only by the actions that are taken up does it move and operate. So we are what we do. There is no I, it's just that seventh consciousness that gives us the sense of a I am doing. It's how we go back to being unbounded, unlimited. That's why he starts with generosity. Because the cultivation of generosity begins to take us back to our unboundedness. Take us back to our expansive quality. Take us back to our fullest capacity. It takes us back even to a place that we can become something else. Don't you remember when you were different? When you were one way and now you're different? You're not like that anymore. It could go either way. You've gotten more devilish or you've gotten better. But you change. You're not that anymore. We have a way of calling it shape-shifting. Completely changed, completely different. When one starts to know their full capacity to live and move and have their being in this world. And I'm telling you that it is uber powerful. You no longer feel taken advantage of. You can recognize when someone's taking advantage. You can even choose to let them out of your compassion. The compassion for not so much the mother. She needs to go get a job. Those kids are old enough. They're both in school all day long. She could work part-time, not full-time. But he loves her so much, and he's an Italian background, and their dolls don't work. I'm like, she need to go get a job. I said, send her over here one time when I was hiring for something, and I needed an assistant. And I gave her a job. one day, I said, you can't work for me because you're lazy. You don't work. You've been on your phone all day long. You really don't want to do this, so I don't want you to do it. Not for me. I said, but for you, you need to get yourself a job. And that's my love talking to you. See? No, but I really meant it. But they got to iron that out. But for the sake of the children, I will help. Okay, so now I'm going to finish. And we're going to invite the heavenly beings. You know, we're about as heavenly as you get here on earth, right? We're like at the top of the food chain, you might say. And I know you got to be sure that there's got to be something higher than us, right? Higher than this, because we're not that good. So if this was the best, what would be the purpose for this whole creation if this was the best it could churn out? You know, I personally think that the Buddhas are the best. You know, but they got there as they begin to drop off their illusionary thinking. And they begin to expand and come to know their full capacity. And the joy that comes with that, with not being owned by any man, free. And they can just move through this existence, not feeling bound or coerced or ridden or overruled or, you know, that out of them is a fountain of wisdom that flows, that the capacity to have clear eyesight, you know, and to just feel good, not only about oneself, but to feel good about people every day. I know when I'm looking at bad people that I'm looking at them with a different eye because I was a bad person. And I found my goodness. So he can too. She can too. You know, but sometimes it depends on who they encounter that reinforces what. Somebody sends in a voice, sounds like an echo. Hello, 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 hello. He said, think of life like an echo. That's one way I work with people who are like troublesome. When I'm thinking in my mind, ugh, this is going to be the pits, or I just don't feel like dealing with this, then I think of life like an echo. Hello, 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 hello. You know, and I remember that I thought that way at one time, but now I think differently. I just kept hearing it over and over and over and over and over, hearing the Dhamma, and it drowned out the other voices that I was hearing over and over and over and over and over and over. So I think of him like me, and he can change, and I use the imagery of an echo. So if I sit down to meditate, I'm going to give you some hacks now. These are shortcuts. When I sit down to meditate, I don't have to go through the whole analysis thing. You know, I don't have to go through why he's like he is. I don't have to go through the internal base met the external base. Consciousness arose. The three of those made contact. With contact came feeling. I don't have time for all of that. You know, I learned it because now it's like zip. You know, I learned it. But now it's like zip, internal base. I met the external base, saw something. Consciousness arose, meaning I recognized what I saw. The three of those come together, trouble brewing, make contact. With contact comes feeling. I didn't feel so good about that. That was my boyfriend, and I see him with somebody, and they're going into lunch counter place. What you call those places? They're going to eat. Restaurant. So, and automatically my mind is going somewhere. What? It's he's supposed to be at work. Right? So So my mind is fabricating a story around this now. Internal basement, external base consciousness arose. I know what I saw. The three of those make contact. Well, contact comes feeling. Now, like, I'm feeling like something wrong. And with feeling comes grasping or clinging. Now I'm clinging to my view, idea of what I think it is. No. And then with that starts the whole pain cycle, you see. And so Buddha says there's a place that we have to cut that off. He didn't say that we cut it off at feeling. Now, if I was thinking, like if I was in charge of this Dharma, what I would say is cut it off at the source, you know, of ignorance, avidya. Cut it off at avidya, and then you don't have to go through that whole scenario. But he said, no, be observant. You just don't have to get all wrapped up in it and come up with your conclusions about what it is, you know. And so there is the internal base meeting the external. Aren't you glad that you can see, that you can hear, that you can taste, you can touch, and you can feel? You know, aren't you glad? You know, otherwise life would be mighty boring if you couldn't see and you couldn't hear. You didn't have any taste buds. You couldn't feel anything. And you couldn't think anything. What would be the point? And so there is a marvelousness in this life, but we can't experience it or realize it if we're cutting off right there at seeing and hearing and tasting and touching, smelling and thinking. Because after that comes feeling. We feel, and that's how we make, you know, that's why I've never liked the word that we've translated as detachment. Because everybody knows what it feels like when someone treats you with detachment. It's like, I don't even see her. She's not here. She doesn't matter. It's so painful. It's so hurtful. But after that comes the grasping or the clinging. He said you cut it right there between feeling and grasping or clinging. Not at the beginning, so we're supposed to see and hear, taste and touch and smell and think and feel, but not grasp. So you can tell where people are in their practice, whether they've cut the cord too soon. They're unfeeling, you know, and they call that being, noble detachment. No, you're just unfeeling, you know. And so you can tell when it's been cut in the wrong place because the results is not good. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, you see a lot of that in the monastic community. They want a shortcut to Nirvana, is I just cut off all feelings. That's it. They had a hard time with me. I know you can tell. They cut me loose early. You know, you're supposed to say a certain number of years. Bye bye now. We're going to release you. You can go. So I was glad about that. I was very glad about that. I had a lot of problems because there's a lot of misogyny. Let's call it what it is. There's a lot of misogyny and patriarchal wrong mindset within, you know, all of the, you know, religiously organized. We have reorganized religiously, you know. But in spite of all of that, when you find this power, you maintain your liberty. You actually come into your freedom. And if you are tenacious, never giving up, change comes about. If you have the patience to bring it. Patience is a power. It's you know, it's not the aftermath of some, you know, in Christianity, they talk about patience. And they said, well, patience comes through tribulation. So when I read that, I wanted a lot of the good qualities, but not patience. I said, that's okay on the patience thing, because I didn't want the tribulation part, you know. But I found that you can't outrun this. You know, there are laws in place that govern the universe, and one of them is for one's virtue to excel that one has to develop the power of patience, because that's what allows time for things to shift. And so it came to me that the only way some things are going to change is some people who hold the power over that, they just have to die. So I'm going to have to, like, just be patient, you know, because they are not going to change their mind. And suddenly all my anxiety was gone. I said, okay, so I will have patience, you know, and they can hold their view, but they don't own me. They can talk about me and be unhappy with me, but they don't own me. And I will just operate out of what I think is good and right. And that can be a lonely life if you need friends to make you feel like you're something or important. But if you've cut at the right place in that dependent origination between feeling and grasping and clinging, then you will see the power of making the right cut in the right place. You can feel everything, and yet it does not consume you. You can feel the pain beyond what your seeming enemy says to you. You can actually feel his pain that makes him think that way, that makes him hold that view, as messed up as it is. You get a little tinge of his messed upness. You can feel it, and now you know it all together. And you know how to deal with that one, how to talk with that one. And that's a wisdom that you cannot get out of a book. It's also a wisdom that you cannot get from your teacher. You can get the finger pointing to it, but you only get it going through the experience of it. Now that's what Buddha Dharma is. It's not knowing some things. It's not plopping down on a pillow because you need some mental relief. It's to awaken you to your true, unbridled nature. And so there's a couple of ways that we can work with this, but today, or for today, I'd like to work with you in a little different way, meaning I'd like to take you out of your step-by-step mental process. And I'd like to put you more into the feeling, yet finding where you cut and let go of grasping. And that's a quicker way. It's like a Kubler-Ross, the five stages of grief. And I don't know what they are, because I needed something that was shorter than five stages. And so I don't know. Does anybody know them? Denial. Okay, so it starts with denial, and it ends, you know, and it goes to grief or something like that, and then it ends at acceptance. I'm like, just cut them out, and we'll just go, you know, I'll just go right to acceptance. You know, that's what I don't want to go through the analytical process and all of that. Just if this is where we're going to come out at the other end, how can I just get right to there? I choose that. And I tell you, in doing so, when my friend died, didn't shed a tear because I held it, you know, but that there was no tear to shed because in that moment, I understood that all compounded things are impermanent. All. Including him. Including me. Some days I wake up, I'm like, oh, Samsara again? You know, I wake up, I'm still here in Samsara. Well, I better make the best of it. I must not be ready yet. You know, something else I can do today to ensure my destination. You know, but I do. I wake up, oh, here we go, like Groundhog Day. Who wants to live forever? But actually, this is a false kind of living because this is a compounded fabrication, this particular existence. So if anybody listened to the Prajnaparamita, our sutra that I read last night, it talks about form is none other than emptiness. Emptiness is none other than form, propelled by cause and effect. It takes different appearances. And so there is the arising, or there is birth. And I've aged, we're going to take a break in 12 minutes. Take a break. So there has been aging. We've been aging while we're sitting here, even though we can't see it. If we had some other kind of eye apparatus, you know, that could break things down to smaller particles, we could see it. I probably had a million cells that died in the last 2 hours, you know, and maybe half a million that were born. The birthing ones are getting less and less, you know, so more dying than a birthing. And so I have old age, you know. And there is the truth of sickness and death. And that just means the breaking apart of the compounded thing. First, the air will cut off, the air element dispersed. Then the fire element, then the water element, and then finally the earth element, the bones. So that's the physical aspect, right? And then there is the vibrational aspect. These two will separate, so we call it mind-body. These two will separate. And then like that, this is where the life was, right? That was the body. This is the life part, like that wick. Lighting another candle to bring about the consequence of the actions of this life. Can't say it's me, because now my compoundedness has ended. Can't say it's me. Can't say it's not me, because there was the spark that was carrying the seeds of all unfulfilled actions. So some people call it reincarnation. Others call it rebirth linking consciousness. No. So when I started at reincarnation. I could find in all of the spiritual traditions the speaking of this. But when I got into the Dhamma through the Theravada gate, I switched it to rebirth linking consciousness. It's not me, it's just the force of karma moving. Now I take either one of them because they mean the same thing to me. It's just words trying to express something that's really sort of beyond our words. We don't have the words for it. We get as close to it as something like this. And I can hold both of those, the notion of there being a reincarnation, but yet it's just the rebirth linking consciousness, so only one Panavati. And that's just so easy for me to hold. It's like a non-thing. I mean, because if it's the combination of those two, it just is, whether my mind gets with it or not. You know, so I just make it easy. I allow my mind to just get with it. And before you know it, it's easy to see. It's easy to see both aspects of it. And there is no disjointedness. It's like having a coin and it has two sides. It's just one coin, but it has two sides. And so that's how you overcome conflicting understanding. When our understanding is not full, that's what confusion is. So when we're confused and we have conflicting, but is it like this? We have to make everything so concrete because we're looking at everything through a false lens of concreteness that happens to be our station. You know, it's just like we're walking on the earth. We get down in the water, we're in a whole different space then. You know, but there's some that's in the water. If they got thrown up on the land, they'd be in a whole different space and they'd be in trouble. But there's some that are they called amphibians? They can be in the water and they can be on the land. So they know water and they know land. No conflict. We're just limited. We know land, not water. But I tell you, there are all of these realms of existence that Buddha was letting us know about. And that we can abide in these multiple spaces. We call them, for lack of a better word, states. We get into certain states. And when we're in that particular state, then we inherit or we have privy to all of the information that's available in that state. We have information and we have understanding of whatever wisdom is in that plane. So I can be in this body, but if I enter vibrationally into that state, then in this body I have access to the wisdom that is on that plane. Are you listening to me? Because I want you to really know that there is something more to this. And that appearance here was for a reason. Not self-development like we think, but to expose, reveal, remind us of, to let us know what our inherent, intrinsic nature is. I know you feel more capable, more aware, more powerful, more useful than you are. That's your signal. That's your sign right there. You know that there is something more. You just can't figure out how to get into it. But you know. And he said, through listening. First one listens. So the way that my last Buddha master taught us is that we couldn't take any notes. He would just teach, because while I'm taking a note, I'm not hearing something. So something's missing now, and then when I try to piece it all together, it doesn't. And already scientists tell us that we don't hear every word. We like hop, and we fill in the blanks. Did you know that? When you think you're hearing every word, they said, no, you don't. Like every five words, and then the mind fills in the blanks based on past experience. She must be talking about this. And so he wouldn't allow us to take any notes until we had her, and then the recordings, you know, the talks were recorded, and then we had to listen to them 7 times before we could take notes. So by the time we had to listen to the same Dharma talk 7 times, he was losing some of us. We like, I just can't hear it. I've gotten what I'm going to get from that for now. And so he said, okay, for you Westerners, I'm going to cut it down to 3 because I know how y'all are. And so, because he was Chinese. And so, I mean, Chinese, you just tell them it's done. You know, whatever you say, that's what goes. Like us, it's like, why? I'm like, that doesn't make sense to me. Like, oh, I already knew that. Well, I disagree with that. And he said, like, you haven't even heard it. You haven't pondered it. You haven't, you know, you haven't contemplated it. You have nothing. It's just all while I'm talking, you like rearranging what I'm saying and spitting it out, rejecting. And, you know, so he said, through listening. He said, a Buddha inculcates your mind. That's exactly what I'm doing. I'm inculcating your mind. I'm turning the picture around. So you see, you know how you have this picture and you look at it this way and it looks like a horse, and you look at it this way and it's a lady's head or something like that. You know, so he says, I'm turning it around. And after a while, because every time you look, you just see the same thing, the horse's head, the horse's head, the horse's head. But then I'm telling you about the lady that's also in the picture. Can you see that? And it's like, oh, oh yeah, oh, there it is. I see it. So you go back, get away from it, go back and look, horse's head. And then you look, and then the lady's head appears. Then you go back. You come back again, horse's head, lady's head. I see it. Then you leave and you come back, horse's head, lady's head. And then you turn, you come back. I can just choose either one. I can choose the lady's head, I can choose the horse's head, but I see them all because now the mind has been inculcated in a certain way. And so that's why he gave these teachings. So that we would know, understand cause and effect. So we would know that we fully have a choice between suffering and not suffering. And it could be as simple as changing one's view. Like right now, my view is that I am dying daily, right? So that when the moment of death comes, I won't cling to what has been dying and dying and decaying and decaying, I will be moving towards the newness of the life that is arising based on causality. And that means that I can go through this because my sight is fixed and it's set. And I can see the glory of the arising because I am altering my 3 karmas of thought, speech, and action, so that whatever they produce will be a fruit that I want going forward. You see, so we have total control. It may look like the control is out there, but that's because we gave it up. And he teaches us how to reclaim that intrinsic, all-powerful, all-knowing nature of Buddha. Now, when I'm really going to break, because I said at 11, and it's 11 right now. Just give me one more minute. And when that comes, I no longer think that I am a person who possesses things, you know. I no longer think so much. On one hand, I know I'm a person. But on the other hand, I never think of myself as a person. I won't say never. Occasionally I do. And every time I do, it's a uh-oh. You know? Every time I do, I encounter a hiccup. You know, it's like you just try to go. I encounter a hiccup when I think of myself as that. So that's what he said. You know, just think of yourself as what you think, say, and do. Wholesome or unwholesome. beneficial or not beneficial, useful or not useful. He said, think of others as yourself. So when I have a choice to make about something that you want or something that I want, how do I evaluate that? What's best for me and whatever's left over, I give it to you? Or do I look at both of our situations and say, I have a little bit more time to you know, avail myself of some kind of resource. She doesn't have time. Her need is greater than mine, and give it. Give it as if I'm giving it to myself because I see her as myself. Now you say that this, I'm not sure this can be done. It can be done. Do I say I do that 100%? No, I don't. But that's the framework by which I govern my life. So I know when I've been good and I know when I've been bad. I know. And I don't make an excuse for myself. I just say, oh, I could have done better than that. Oh, I have a desire to have done better than that, to be better than that. But I wasn't. But I'm going to work hard at it because I don't take it personal. I don't take it personally. You don't take it personally. You just understand these universal principles and you learn how to operate within them more and more. So I want you to go ahead and take a break. And why don't we just take a break and you can walk. Might need to get up out of the chairs. It's 11:03 and I'll see you at 11:30. Then we'll do our opening and we'll go into our first meditation. I didn't forget about the opening. It's just when something's coming, sometimes you just have to be with that.